Get started. The topic today is global bifurcations, and I'll explain what that means in just a second. But let me remind you that there's no lecture next week. I'll be out of town. So we'll meet again in 2 weeks, and we'll start talking about two-parameter bifurcation diagrams in 2 weeks. Today's lecture finishes up our discussion of one-parameter bifurcation diagrams and the codimension one bifurcations. We've talked about the first couple of bifurcations on this list, the saddle node and the hop bifurcation, and the cyclic fold bifurcation. Those are all local bifurcations. By that we mean that you can recognize these bifurcations by looking at the vector field in a neighborhood close to a solution of the differential equation. So both the saddle loop and hop bifurcations can be identified from the eigenvalues of the Jacobian matrix, which represents the linearization of the vector field around a steady state. So, and we, by looking at the linearization around the steady state, we can see when the steady state goes unstable, and when it goes unstable, then something interesting happens. Okay, you have a saddle node bifurcation, or a hop bifurcation, and we can do the same thing around a periodic solution. I showed you that at the end of the last lecture, that you can linearize the vector field around the periodic solution, and examine the stability of the periodic solution. That's determined by these things called flow-k multipliers. And when the flow-k multipliers cross the unit circle in the complex plane, then the periodic solution loses stability, and you get a bifurcation of the periodic solution. But those are all local bifurcations because you can see them just by examining the vector field in the neighborhood of a known solution. The global bifurcations, on the other hand, we'll talk today about the saddle loop and the saddle node invariant circle bifurcations. These bifurcations create limit cycles in a global sense. They're not local, they're not small amplitude limit cycles, they're large amplitude limit cycles, and they come from interactions in the vector field over large portions of the state space. So we can't rely on a local linearization. We have to rely on much more complicated arguments to find these bifurcations. Now, the proofs of the theorems that I'm going to talk about today are quite difficult, and we're not going to even attempt to do any of that. I'm only going to draw pictures. And from the pictures, I think you can easily see how these bifurcations occur. And ultimately, to find the bifurcations, you let the computer software do the work for you. You just have to understand when you can expect to see them and how it is that these periodic solutions are arising from the global characteristics of the vector field. So I want to start by defining what the mathematicians call a homoclinic orbit. This is the place to start. So let's start with just a simple saddle point. So the yellow dot is a steady state, and when we look at the linearization of the vector field around the steady state, we find there's one eigendirection which is attracting, and the vectors point in, and there's one eigendirection in which the vector field is repelling, and trajectories go away from the saddle point. Now, let's follow the trajectory that's leaving the saddle point in a northeasterly direction. And let's suppose that that trajectory goes away from the saddle point, so it's no longer controlled by the linearization, and it bends around and it comes back and it returns to the saddle point along the stable direction. That's called a homoclinic orbit, or a saddle loop. It loops out from the saddle and then comes back to the saddle. Okay, so that's a homoclinic orbit, in particular, a saddle loop. Let me give you a second example of a homoclinic orbit. In this case, the steady state is a saddle node. So it's stable in three directions and unstable in one direction. It has a zero eigenvalue. This is the eigendirection that's associated with the zero eigenvalue. This direction is associated with a negative eigenvalue. Okay? Now let's follow the trajectory that leaves the saddle node and suppose that it loops around to the back and approaches the saddle node from the other side. That would also be a homoclinic orbit, in this case a saddle node loop. It loops around from a saddle node and comes back to the saddle node. Okay? So these are examples of homoclinic orbits. Here's a third example of a homoclinic orbit. In this case, it's a three-dimensional state space. There's one positive eigenvalue that repels trajectories, and there's a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues with negative real parts. So this steady state is attracting in this two-dimensional manifold like a stable focus, but it's repelling in a one-dimensional manifold. And again, let's follow the trajectory as it leaves that steady state and then comes back and approaches it in the stable manifold. Okay? This kind of a steady state is called a saddle focus. And again, we can have a homoclinic orbit. So homoclinic orbits are orbits that leave a saddle point, go off into the distance, and then come back and return to the saddle point. There's also the notion of heteroclinic orbits. And in this case, a heteroclinic orbit is a trajectory that leaves one saddle point and sails into a different saddle point. So it's heteroclinic because the saddle points are different, as opposed to a homoclinic orbit where it's the same saddle point. Okay? So a heteroclinic orbit, a saddle-saddle connection, is a connection from one saddle point to a different saddle point. And, of course, this can happen in high dimensions, but the characteristic is that you have a connection between saddle points. Okay, you with me? Now, let's think first about this heteroclinic orbit that connects two saddle points. I want you to realize that this is an unusual situation. It only happens for a particular combination of parameter values that you can get the saddle-saddle connection. In general, if we change any parameter in the system a little bit that affects the vector fields around these saddle points, we'll break the connection between the two saddles. And the connection between the two saddles can break in one of two different directions. Okay? So you're always following the trajectory that comes out of the leftmost saddle and as it comes towards the saddle on the right side. If we could break the saddle-saddle connection by having this trajectory come out of the left-hand saddle and kind of graze the right-hand saddle and then come down here in a southwesterly direction, or it could graze the saddle point on the other side and head off in a northeasterly direction. Okay? So very close to this saddle-saddle connection are two entirely different phase portraits, depending upon whether the connection is broken on one side or broken on the other side. The two pictures, the two extreme pictures, are robust, meaning if I have either of the pictures in the extreme and I change any parameter just a little bit, I'll move the trajectories a little bit, but the overall picture won't change. Okay? It's a robust. This portrait is robust to small parameter changes. This portrait is also robust to small parameter changes. But the one in the middle is not robust to parameter changes, so it's a bifurcation point. And we can call that a heteroclinic bifurcation point. So it's a codimension one bifurcation. We only have to change one parameter to pass through that bifurcation point. Just like, so similar to the case of a saddle node or a hop bifurcation. Those are all codimension one bifurcations. Okay? Now, we're more interested in homoclinic orbits, but homoclinic orbits have the same property. A homoclinic orbit is not robust. If you twiddle the parameters a little bit, you break the saddle-saddle connection. And you break the connection to one side or to the other. So, if you look on the left, the saddle-saddle connection has been broken, and now the trajectory that comes out of the saddle point eventually sails past and goes off to the southwest. But if you go to the other side of the bifurcation and you follow the trajectory that's coming out of the saddle point, it breaks to the other side, and now it has to wind onto a closed orbit. We live in two dimensions, and the second steady state is an unstable focus. It's repelling trajectories, so there has to exist a stable periodic solution that captures those trajectories. So this is an example of a saddle loop bifurcation. At the bifurcation point, you have a saddle loop homoclinic orbit, and as you go past the bifurcation point, it gives birth to a periodic solution. And this periodic solution has large amplitude because it's a global bifurcation. In order to create the saddle loop connection, the trajectory has to sail away from the saddle point into the distance and then come around and come back. And the limit cycle, when it's first born, is born from that saddle loop bifurcation. So it has a large amplitude. But the limit cycle also, when you give birth to a limit cycle via this bifurcation, the limit cycle also has an infinite period. So the reason it has an infinite period is because when you're just past the bifurcation, the limit cycle inherits the properties of that saddle loop homoclinic orbit. And that homoclinic orbit, it takes an infinite amount of time to get around that homoclinic orbit because there's a steady state on that orbit. And the vector field around the steady state is very small. All the time derivatives are close to zero in the neighborhood of the steady state. So it takes a very long time to escape from the steady state. Once you escape from the steady state, then you can pick up speed and zoom around that homoclinic orbit. But now as you come back towards the saddle point on from the other side, as you approach the saddle point, the speed slows down and slows down and slows down. And it takes an infinite amount of time to come back to the saddle point. It takes an infinite amount of time to leave. It takes an infinite amount of time to return. Okay? And when the limit cycle is born by breaking the saddle loop bifurcation, it takes an infinite amount of time to get around the limit cycle because the limit cycle grazes very close to the saddle point. And the vector field close to the saddle point is very small. Okay? So the limit cycle has to have an infinite period when it's born. And something very similar happens in the vicinity of a saddle node loop. The pictures are a little bit different. To the left of the saddle node loop, we have a situation where I have a stable node and an unstable saddle point, very close to each other, okay? And the homoclinic orbit is the orbit that leaves the saddle point and comes around to the back side and approaches the stable node from the back side. Okay? And to finish out the picture, I have an unstable focus that's sending trajectories away here. And they either approach the saddle point or they come into the stable node. Now, this picture is robust. If I twiddle the parameters a little bit, I move the steady states around, I move the vector field around a little bit, but that picture stays the same. But eventually, as I change the parameter in the system, eventually I can push the saddle and the node together. And when I push them together, that's a one, that's a codimension one bifurcation, pushing the saddle node together to get a saddle node point. That's a codimension one bifurcation, but the orbit still remains. This is not a homoclinic orbit. If I must have, maybe I misspoke myself, right? Because this orbit doesn't come back to a saddle point. It comes back to a stable node. So there's nothing wrong with this orbit. This orbit's perfectly robust. But when the saddle and the node come together, now the situation is no longer robust. We still have this orbit that connects a saddle node to itself, but as we push the parameters a little bit further, remember the saddle node disappears altogether, and there's no longer any steady state at this part of the state space, and now the system has to evolve to a stable limit cycle. But this stable limit cycle has finite amplitude because it's born from this global homoclinic orbit, and it has infinite period because when you're in this region of the limit cycle, you're close to where there used to be a steady state, and that has to be reflected in the fact that the vector field is very small here. The rates of change are very small because there used to be a steady state there. So it takes a long time for the limit cycle to pass through this region of the state space. And then it can pick up speed and run around the backside. And when it comes back here, it has to slow down again and takes a long time to get through that part of the state space. So the limit cycle has a very long period when it's first born. So this is also a codimension one bifurcation that creates infinite period limit cycles. In this case, it's called a SNC bifurcation because the homoclinic orbit is called a saddle node invariant circle, a SNC, a saddle node invariant circle. So what do we mean by the terminology? An invariant circle is a closed locus of points in state space that's invariant in the sense that if I start anywhere on that circle, I'll stay on that circle forever. So it's invariant with respect to the vector field. If I start on the circle, I stay on the circle. But it's not a limit cycle. Because it's not a periodic solution. You don't go round and round that homoclinic orbit because there's a steady state on the invariant circle, and the steady state is the saddle node. So it's a saddle node on an invariant circle. And what's the invariant circle? The invariant circle is the homoclinic orbit plus the saddle point. Makes it for an invariant circle. And notice, the invariant circle also exists here. There's also an invariant circle to this vector field. The invariant circle is the orbit that comes out of the saddle point and comes into the node, plus the node, plus the saddle point, plus this little trajectory that comes out of the saddle point and into the node from the other side. You put those four pieces together, and topologically, you have an invariant circle. You have a topological circle in state space, and it's invariant because if I start at any point on that invariant circle, I'll stay on that invariant circle forever. Okay? So the existence of this invariant circle is the basis of the creation of the limit cycle via this bifurcation. Do you have any questions? Yeah, this is perfectly robust. By robust, I mean if I have this picture and I change the parameters a little bit, you know, one part in a million, I change the parameter, then the picture will still look like this. All the steady states will move a little bit, all the trajectories will move a little bit, but the nature, the topology of the picture will be exactly the same. It's robust to parameter variations. And the picture on this side is also robust to parameter variations. But this picture, the saddle node on an invariant circle, that's not robust to parameter variations because you know when you vary the parameters a little bit, you break the saddle node. You either break it to the left and you pull the saddle and the node apart, in which case you don't have a limit cycle, or you break to the other side, in which case the saddle node disappears, and now instantaneously you have a limit cycle. It's now a periodic orbit. But it has infinite period. That's what it inherits from its parent, that infinite time that it takes to get around. Pardon me? No, these are homoclinic orbits. No, this is not a heteroclinic because a heteroclinic connects one saddle point to another saddle point, okay? And this connects a saddle point to a stable node. That's perfectly fine. Okay? It's the saddle-saddle connection that's not robust. And when the two saddles happen to be the same saddle, then it's called a homoclinic orbit. And it can be a saddle point or it can be a saddle node. Okay? Okay. Let's compare the properties of the limit cycles that are born via this mechanism with limit cycles that are born via a Hopf bifurcation. So what are the two main characteristics of limit cycles that are born via a Hopf bifurcation? There are two defining characteristics. I think I heard it. Small amplitude, right? The limit cycles, when they're born at a Hopf bifurcation, initially they have a very small amplitude. And as you move away from the Hopf bifurcation, the amplitude grows. And the amplitude grows like the square root of the distance from the Hopf bifurcation. Okay, so that's property number one. They're small amplitude limit cycles. What's property number two? They have a finite period and a finite frequency. Remember, the period is 2 pi divided by the frequency. And what's the frequency of the Hopf limit cycles? How do you get the frequency of the bifurcating limit cycles at a Hopf bifurcation? The frequency is essentially the number of turns per second, right? That's the frequency. And where does that come from? Those bifurcating limit cycles inherit the frequency from the steady state, right? What kind of steady states are the limit cycles coming from? When those limit cycles are born by a Hopf bifurcation, they come from a steady state that's a focus, right? It has a pair of complex conjugate eigenvalues. And the real part is changing sign. The real part is going from negative to zero to positive. That means the focus is going from stable when the real part is negative to unstable when the real part is positive. And the bifurcation occurs at that particular parameter value where the real part is equal to zero. Okay? So as the limit, as the steady state loses stability and the limit cycles are born, they're initially small amplitude because they're close to that steady state, and the frequency at which they're spinning is the same as the frequency at which trajectories are spinning around the focus. And that frequency is the imaginary part of the eigenvalue. Okay? So hop bifurcations are small amplitude, and they inherit their frequency, the time it takes to go round, they inherit that from the steady state that gives them birth. Okay? And they're small amplitude because it's a local bifurcation. Everything is happening close to the steady state where the linearization of the differential equations holds. Now, what about these global bifurcations that give birth to limit cycles from a homoclinic orbit? What are the two defining properties of these limit cycles? So they have an infinite period or zero frequency, right? The frequency is small. The period is large. They inherit that from the nature of the bifurcation because you had a steady state on the invariant circle. You had a steady state on the invariant circle. So they have to have infinite period when they're born, zero frequency. And what about their amplitude? Their amplitude is large because they inherit their amplitude from the homoclinic orbit. Okay? So essentially there are two ways to give birth to periodic solutions in a vector field, in a dynamical system. The one route is via a hop bifurcation where the limit cycles have small amplitude and finite frequency. Small amplitude, finite frequency. And the other route is through a homoclinic bifurcation, in which case the limit cycles have small frequency and finite amplitude. So they're completely opposite characteristics. But they're both perfectly valid and regularly seen bifurcations for creating periodic solutions. Okay? So, next I want to just talk about the Andronov-Leontovich theorem, which formalizes the situation in a two-dimensional state space. So if we just have two variables and just two differential equations, then we live in a plane. Our state space is a plane, and there are certain restrictions to living in a plane which allow you to prove that a homoclinic orbit gives birth to a finite amplitude, large period limit cycle that's either stable, given this picture that I've been describing, or it can give birth to large amplitude unstable periodic solutions in the cartoons on the bottom. And all I've done is kind of change the direction of the vector field. So just like a hop bifurcation can give rise to either stable or unstable limit cycles, small amplitude limit cycles, depending upon which side of the bifurcation the limit cycles appear, The Andronov-Leontovich theorem says that this homoclinic orbit can give birth to either a stable or unstable large amplitude limit cycle, depending upon the way the vector field is spinning. So in this case, the focus is an unstable focus, and we get a stable limit cycle around an unstable focus. In this case, everything's spinning around a stable focus, and when the limit cycle is born, it has to be an unstable limit cycle. Okay? That's a consequence of living in two dimensions. And it's easy to draw these pictures. Actually, you should practice. Tonight, you should just get out a sheet of white paper and try and draw these vector fields and respect the continuity of the vector fields. And pretty soon after you practice this a little bit, you'll see how these global bifurcations are kind of enforced by the continuity of the vector field. And that's how I drew these to begin with. I didn't look them up in a book. I just kind of recreated them because this is the way they have to look. Okay. So here's the slide that compares the Hopf bifurcation with the homoclinic bifurcation, which is what we did a little bit earlier. Okay, so that slide was out of order. So next, I want to talk about a more complicated theorem called Shilnikov theorem, which describes what happens to vector fields when we live in higher dimensions. Okay. So the Andronov-Leontovich theorem holds for two-variable dynamical systems, a two-dimensional state space. And you get a nice, simple result because of the constraints of living in two dimensions. But as soon as you go to three dimensions or higher, then more complicated things can happen. Okay? And Shilnikov's theorem describes what happens in a three-dimensional system when you have a homoclinic orbit. It gives birth to either stable or unstable limit cycles, or possibly to a much more complicated behavior. And let me just try to describe what Shilnikov said. So in three dimensions, we have two different kinds of scenarios. The homoclinic orbit, of course, comes out of a saddle point and comes back to the saddle point. But what we're distinguishing here is what kind of a saddle point it is. What's the nature of the attracting manifold? If in the attracting manifold the saddle point looks like a node, so that means it has real eigenvalues, and the trajectories come straight into the stable node, that case, all the eigenvalues of the system are real. Two of them are negative. That's the stable manifold. And one of them is positive. That's what makes it a saddle. Okay? The other possibility is that of the three eigenvalues of the Jacobian matrix, one of them is positive because it's a saddle. The other two are a complex conjugate pair with negative real parts, so that in the stable manifold, the trajectories are spiraling into the saddle point. Those are the two possibilities. Okay. Now, what Shilnikov said is you have to calculate this number sigma, which is the sum of the positive eigenvalue plus the negative eigenvalue with that's closest to zero. Okay. So it's the sum of those two eigenvalues. That's sigma. And in the case of a saddle focus, you add lambda 1 to the real part of lambda 2 and lambda 3. So you calculate this number sigma, and the stability of the bifurcating limit cycles depends upon this number sigma. And the theorem says, in the case of a normal saddle, if sigma is less than zero, then the homoclinic orbit gives rise to one stable limit cycle. And if sigma is greater than zero, then it gives rise to a unique but unstable limit cycle. So in this case, perfectly reasonable result. In the case of a saddle focus, if sigma is less than zero, Then the bifurcation again gives rise to one stable limit cycle. But if sigma is greater than zero, then the homoclinic orbit, when it bifurcates, gives rise to an infinite number of unstable limit cycles plus a stable chaotic attractor. And this is completely unexpected by most people, myself included, that this all hell breaks loose at a saddle focus when sigma is larger than zero. And I can't give you an intuitive explanation for why this happens, and I can't prove this theorem for you. It's too hard for me, but it's something to remember that in three dimensions and in higher dimensions, these homoclinic orbits can give rise to very complicated behavior. Okay? And you don't necessarily get a nice, well-behaved limit cycle. In fact, what you get is a chaotic attractor, and there's a formal definition of what you mean by a chaotic attractor. So, questions about this part? Yeah, Barsh? Okay, I can give you a chemical example. There's this famous chemical reaction called the Belousov-Zhabotinsky reaction. And the Belousov-Zhabotinsky reaction does exhibit chaotic behavior, real deterministic chaos, which I haven't defined for you, but that's proven for the Beze reaction. And I suspect that some of that chaos comes from a Shilnikov-type bifurcation, although I can't demonstrate that for you. There are many different routes to chaos. This is only one route to chaos. There's another route called the period doubling route to chaos. And I think the Beze reaction shows all the standard routes to chaos, but I can't assure you of that off the top of my head. In biochemistry and in biology, this is still very much an open question, whether biological systems exhibit this kind of deterministic chaos. The problem is, how would you ever know? Because cells are very small, and they're subject to random molecular noise on top of the deterministic dynamics of the system governed by the differential equations. So you always have to worry in living cells how much the stochastic fluctuations inside the cell affects the predictions of your differential equation model, right? Now, normally, that's not much of a problem, right? If the differential equation predicts a stable steady state and small perturbations from the steady state come right back, that's not going to be disturbed much by noise. Because what does noise do? Noise kicks you off the steady state, but then the deterministic interactions bring you back again. And noise keeps kicking you off, but the underlying deterministic vector field keeps sucking you back in again. So all noise does is, instead of having a fixed steady state, you get a little blur, right? Because you're all the time jiggling the system, but it stays close to that stable steady state. The same with if you have a stable limit cycle, right? If you have a stable limit cycle in the deterministic system, you have a perfectly periodic solution. It always repeats itself exactly. If the system is a little bit stochastic, then the noise all the time kicking you off the limit cycle, but because it's a stable limit cycle, it's all the time pulling you back. Okay? So instead of seeing a perfectly periodic solution, you see a periodic solution with a little jiggle on it due to the noise. Okay? But what happens to a chaotic attractor if you put noise on it? What does that do to the chaotic attractor? And actually, this has not been sorted out. It's still an open question. It could easily, because it depends. When you have chaotic attractors, you often have other attractors at the same time. It can be a multiply stable system. It can have a chaotic attractor, and it can also have a stable steady state. And those two attractors have, in the deterministic system, they have domains of attraction, right? They have certain initial conditions carry you to the chaotic attractor, other initial conditions carry you to the stable, steady state. Okay? Now, if that's the case, and you put noise on top of the system, and you try to put yourself on the chaotic attractor, you move around on the chaotic attractor, but the noise is all the time jiggling you, and once the noise jiggles you out of the domain of attraction of the chaotic attractor into the domain of attraction of the stable, steady state, then you get sucked into the stable, steady state, and you can't go back. Okay? So a chaotic attractor is probably not robust to noise if there are other stable attractors in the system, which there are likely to be. But even if there's no other stable attractor, even if the only stable attractor is the chaotic attractor, how would you know, could you prove you were on a chaotic attractor rather than just a noisy limit cycle, right? Because kind of the property of a chaotic attractor is it never exactly closes on itself. It's not a periodic solution. It has very subtle characteristics. In the deterministic system, there are very subtle characteristics of a chaotic attractor that can be used to prove that that's what it is. But when you put it in a small volume with lots of molecular noise and lots of jostling, nobody knows whether you would be able to recognize it as a chaotic attractor with noise on it or just as a limit cycle with noise on it. A stable chaotic attractor, right? A chaotic attractor is a really strange beast, okay? I'll tell you a little bit about them. I'm not an expert, okay? A steady state is a zero-dimensional attractor. In your state, your n-dimensional state space, a steady state has zero dimensions, right? It's just a point, okay? A limit cycle is a one-dimensional attractor, okay? In an n-dimensional state space, right? Last week, I described to you what I called the torus bifurcation of a limit cycle. In the torus bifurcation of the limit cycle, what started out as a one-dimensional limit cycle bifurcates to a donut, okay? A donut around the limit cycle, and your trajectory just winds around that donut and never closes on itself. That's a two-dimensional attractor, right? Because the surface of a donut is a two-dimensional surface, okay? That's not a chaotic attractor. A chaotic attractor, by definition, has a fractal dimension. When you try to define the geometric dimension of the object, it turns out to have a fractional dimension between 1 and 2, or even bigger than 2. So it's really weird from a geometric point of view. And furthermore, if you start out with two points that are close together with a stable, steady state, then of course, as time proceeds, they come closer and closer together because they're all trying to get to the steady state. If you start out close to a stable limit cycle, two points close together and close to a stable limit cycle, eventually they'll stay close together because they'll just go around the limit cycle together. But if you start out with two points close together on a chaotic attractor, then after a little time, they start getting further and further apart from each other. So it's weird, and those are the kind of the huge marks of a chaotic attractor. And as I said, in the Belousov-Jabotinsky reaction, you can see all of these characteristics. They're easy to observe because it occurs in a beaker, right? With concentrations of, millimolar concentrations. So there are gazillion molecules involved in this reaction. You can't see the noise. You see the deterministic chaos quite clearly. But if you took the BZ reaction and squashed it down into a reactor the size of a bacterium, where there's only thousands of molecules, then nobody knows what would happen to that trajectory. Okay, I didn't really want to get into chaotic attractors, so I'm not going to say any more about them. Oh, okay. So I wanted to draw for you what the bifurcation diagram looks like so you know what to expect when you have global bifurcations. So I've shown you one parameter bifurcation diagrams for saddle nodes and hop bifurcations, and now we'll see where these global bifurcations fit in. Okay? So here's a typical one parameter bifurcation diagram. I'm plotting the steady state level of one of my variables against the value of one of my parameters. I assume when the parameter is small, there's a single stable steady state, and then I follow that steady state using some bifurcation software. As I increase the parameter, it stays a stable steady state. It gets a little larger. Then it goes through a saddle node bifurcation, and I now have a saddle point. Goes through a second saddle node bifurcation here. Then it goes through, well, let me see. I've got this all laid out. Right? Those are the stability of the steady states. Two saddle node bifurcations. Here, a stable steady state loses stability by a hop bifurcation to an unstable steady state. And then out here, the steady state regains stability by a second hop bifurcation. So I've drawn this system with two saddle node bifurcations and two hop bifurcations. Okay? But now, look what happens if we try to follow the small amplitude limit cycles from this hop bifurcation. It's a supercritical hop bifurcation, so as we move away from the hop bifurcation, the small amplitude limit cycles grow in amplitude. Okay? But unfortunately, because the hop bifurcation occurred very close to the saddle node bifurcation, there's a saddle point close to that steady state that had just lost its stability. And as the stable limit cycles grow from the unstable steady state, in a sense they bump into that saddle point that's close by at a saddle loop bifurcation. And they just end there at a saddle loop bifurcation. That kills the limit cycles that come from this hop bifurcation. And if we follow the limit cycles that come from the other hop bifurcation, they also grow in amplitude. They can get very large, but eventually they will end at a saddle loop bifurcation on the other side. Okay? So here's the complete bifurcation diagram. Two saddle nodes, two hop bifurcations, and two saddle loop bifurcations. And now all of the solutions of the differential equations fit together quite nicely in this bifurcation diagram. Okay, there are no loose ends here. We have two families of stable limit cycles. The family on the left is born from this hop bifurcation and dies at this saddle loop. The family on the right is born at this hop bifurcation and dies at this saddle loop. Or vice versa, right? You can think of them being born here and dying over there. And in between the two saddle loops, in this region between the two saddle loops, we have no periodic solutions. We have one stable steady state. We have an unstable saddle, and we have an unstable focus. Okay? So that system, in between the saddle loops, the system is said to be excitable. By excitable, we mean this is a locally stable steady state, so small fluctuations come straight back to this steady state. But if you have a fluctuation that, in a sense, carries you past the saddle point, then the trajectory has to go up in the direction of the other steady state. But that steady state is unstable. So the trajectory has to loop around that unstable state and come back to the vicinity of this stable steady state and then get sucked back in. Okay? So in this region, the system has a very unique character of this of excitability. Small fluctuations come straight back to the steady state, but a sufficiently large fluctuation in the right direction that can carry you past the saddle point will go off on a long excursion before it must return to the steady state, because that steady state is the only attractor in the system. Okay? So there's all kinds of interesting behavior in a system like this. And this is very common in biochemical reaction networks. It just comes from the combination of positive feedback loops that create saddle node bifurcations and negative feedback loops that create oscillations via Hopf bifurcations. And when you put the two together, this is often naturally what arises. A picture looks like this. Now, the limit cycles don't have to end at saddle loop bifurcations. It's also possible that they end at a SNC bifurcation. And the way you recognize a SNC bifurcation is when you're following this family of stable periodic solutions, you follow them back towards the region of bistability, what you find is that the periodic solutions kind of cease to exist exactly where the bistable system is undergoing its saddle node bifurcation. Okay? And furthermore, what happens to the period of these limit cycles as we come close to the bifurcation? What happens to the period? It goes to infinity. So if I were to plot the period as a function of the parameter, the period of the stable limit cycle as a function of the parameter, as I approach the SNC bifurcation, the period will go to infinity. Okay? And if I follow it in the other direction, what happens to the period of the stable limit cycle as I approach the Hopf bifurcation? Does it go to zero? So as I change the parameter and approach the SNC bifurcation, the period goes to infinity. As I approach the Hopf bifurcation, what happens to the period? The period is finite. The period levels off at some finite value. It doesn't go to zero. The period levels off at a finite value, and what is that number? It's 2 pi divided by the imaginary part of the eigenvalue at the Hopf bifurcation. Okay? So one final point I wanted to make, I forgot to make it earlier, the distinction between limit cycles that arise at a Hopf bifurcation and limit cycles that arise at a homoclinic bifurcation. In both cases, if you're trying to look for the limit cycles experimentally, you won't find them. Why? Because when they're first born at a Hopf bifurcation, they're a very small amplitude. So you can't see them because they're not big enough to see, right? You have to move away from the Hopf bifurcation to give them a chance to grow up and get big enough to see. But the signature will be, as you move away from the Hopf bifurcation, when you first can sense that there's a limit cycle there, you see that it's a small amplitude limit cycle, and as you move your parameter away, the amplitude increases, but the period remains pretty much the same, okay? So you don't see them at first because they're small amplitude. They only kind of come into view as they grow up, okay? But a similar problem happens at a homoclinic bifurcation. At a homoclinic bifurcation, at first you can't see the limit cycle. Why can't you see it? The amplitude is big. You should be able to see it because it has a big amplitude. But you can't see it because it has an infinite period. You never wait long enough. Okay? It still looks like there was some kind of a steady state there because you're impatient. Okay? You have to pull away from the bifurcation point. You have to pull the parameter away from the bifurcation point until the period drops enough so that you can see the periodicity of the limit cycle. Okay? So at both extremes, you only really see the limit cycles in between. At the two extremes, you tend to lose track of the limit cycle. You lose track of the limit cycle at this extreme because it just vanishes. It has vanishing amplitude. And you lose track of the limit cycle at this extreme because it takes longer and longer and longer to get around it because the period's going to infinity. Okay? You know, but these are just facts of life. This is what we have to learn. This is what we have to deal with, and this is what molecular regulatory systems have to deal with. These are the way to create oscillations. These are the basic characteristics of these oscillations. And cells either have to live with it or exploit these properties of these bifurcations. Okay, no meeting next week. In 2 weeks, I hope to start on what are called codimension 2 bifurcations and 2-parameter bifurcation diagrams. And that'll give us an even deeper insight into the origins and relationships of these different bifurcation points. Thank you.